From the KBIA newsroom in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. Today, we're talking about pets, how they can change our lives, how we affect them, and how dogs and cats really feel about us. Dr. Rebecca Johnson is a professor at MU's Sinclair School of Nursing, a professor at the College of Veterinary Medicine, and the director of the Research Center for Human-Animal Interaction. Here's our conversation.
Our center was founded in 2005 by myself, and the idea was to combine a program of research and programs about the ways that when you put people and companion animals together, you have benefits for both ends of the leash.
So I think all of us who have animals interact with our animals constantly, but how do you study and sort of quantify those interactions?
They're very interesting things that we can study when we start looking at the role of companion animals in the lives of people and vice versa. One of the things we can look at is neuroendocrine hormones, such as cortisol levels. That's a stress hormone. And when we look at what happens with people and animals, there is an affiliation between the two of them. I'm not speaking about people who don't like animals, because if you don't, you won't have the beneficial effects. But if you do, then the cortisol levels decrease when you interact with that companion animal. We see this interaction occurring with four of the five senses. So you see, hear, touch the animal, and smell the animal. Some would say that's a problem, but I don't particularly think it is necessarily. And so when that happens, then areas in the brain are triggered, and these wonderful things happen, such as this oxytocin hormone is released that makes us feel happy and joyous and good. And the cortisol hormone is decreased. So there are biochemical benefits that we can measure. We can also measure heart rate and the space between heartbeats, because we know that when you interact with an animal, there's a relaxation effect. Your heart rate slows, your respiratory rate slows, and your blood pressure goes down. So that is a beneficial effect we can measure. But then as social scientists, we can measure a whole bevy of very interesting variables using reliable and valid instruments, questionnaires, self-report, and some observational data to identify how your psyche is also affected, how your social sphere might be affected by interacting with companion animals.
And I think a lot of people who have animals know that they sort of force you to get out of the house more often than you otherwise might. You know, they make their little "I have to pee" eyes at you, or "I want to go to the park." And you've looked at some of the benefits that exercise associated with animals can have on aging people. Could you talk a little bit about why that's a population that was of specific interest to you?
The Research Center for Human-Animal Interaction, we look at people in transition. So that includes older people, prison offenders, military veterans who have returned from deployments, families of children with autism. And so we look at these populations because we know that there is quite a high likelihood that there could be some beneficial effect. As in the case of older people, when older people stop their physical activity or decrease their physical activity, there begins this downward spiral, and it does not have a very good outcome. Mm. So when you stop exercising or walking very much, you are less sure in your step, you begin to shuffle, you may trip easier, you may have a fall that often results in a hip fracture or some other fracture. It's not a good thing. So what we wanted to study was whether walking with a dog could be a motivator to enhance physical activity in older people. So we did a three-group trial. A third of the group walked with dogs from the animal shelter. A third of the group walked with a friend or a family member, or if they didn't have either of those, we gave them a student. Mm-hmm. And then the control group just partied their heads off for 12 weeks, and we measured them again. And we measured the normal walking speed of all of these individuals beforehand and then during and after. And what we found was that in the dog group, we had a 28% increase in the normal walking speed. Mm-hmm. And in the human walking companion group, we had a 4% increase, which is not very much, and it was not statistically significant. The control group actually did a little better than the human walkers.
Yeah.
But what we really know from this is not that it's 28% faster that they're walking, the dog walkers, but it is that they are doing more things in their life. They're more capable. They feel more confident. And so they were doing more physical activity just by being engaged in what we had them doing, the dog walking.
So there can be some really concrete long-term health benefits in terms of keeping active through having a pet. But a lot of older people struggle to maintain a pet because it is a lot of work, and a lot of retirement communities don't want you to have a pet. I think there are some communities around here that do allow you to have a pet. Is that correct?
Enter Tiger Place.
Ah, Tiger Place.
Tiger Place, the School of Nursing faculty initiated Tiger Place with corporate partner of AmeriCare, Inc. And in that facility, it is from the very beginning, even when it was just first conceptualized, it would be pet encouraging, not just pet tolerating. There's a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
So there are wide windowsills for cats. Mm-hmm. There are screened little screened-in porches and screened doors. There are walking areas, and there are tiled floors and entryways. We have a veterinary medical exam room there. So we have a program there at Tiger Place called Tiger Place Pet Initiative, and it has three prongs. Number one is that we help people get, if they want a pet, or maintain their pet and take care of it. So we have a team of pet care assistants who go and give dogs more walks if the person can't do extra walks. They empty cat boxes. They carry in heavy supplies. They're generally supportive, and they monitor the animals, give animals medications, give them baths to help support pet care and pet ownership. If a pet is passes away, then we help the owner get another pet if later on they're ready for that. If the owner passes away, we help the pet find a new home. That's one leg of the stool.
Mm-hmm.
The second leg of the stool is a veterinary medical faculty member goes and makes house calls on all of the animals mm-hmm. once a month and takes veterinary medical students along and does very basic things in our veterinary medical exam room right on Tiger Place's premises. That's leg two. Leg three is the positive visits program, in which we have people bringing in animals of all sorts, showing them and telling about them, and the older adults are interacting with them. And the people living at Tiger Place are movers and shakers. They mm-hmm. want to learn. So students prepare a tutorial. We engage students in all phases of the program. And students teach the attendees about the program, about the animal.
And is it sort of taking off? Do you see people replicating it?
Other countries are replicating it. Mm. For example, I'm about to go to Japan doing some lectures, and the Japan Veterinary Medical Association is moving policy to formulate policy to enable people to have pets the way we do at Tiger Place.
Mm. Are there other places like Tiger Place in the United States that you know of?
There are a few.
But not too many.
Not that many.
Mm-hmm.
Not as many as we need. There are many retirement residences that say pets are allowed, but allowing a pet and helping someone to maintain care of their pet are entirely different things.
This is Intersection on KBIA. I'm Sarah Shariari. Today, we're all about animals. Right now, you're hearing from Mizzou Professor Rebecca Johnson, who is director of the Research Center for Human-Animal Interaction. Do you see or do you study the benefits for the residents of keeping their pets?
We have studied older adults on a number of occasions, and others have as well. Really, there's a growing body of research indicating that pets give people a reason to get up in the morning. They also are widely known to exhibit this social lubricant effect,
mm-hmm.
where there's someone to talk to about something, and that's the pet. And that facilitates a lot of transgenerational interaction as well, whereas grandchildren or great-grandchildren may not know exactly what to talk about with their older adult. They may be less comfortable than they once were because of the distances between generations mm-hmm. now and geographically. So the animal gives a vehicle for communication.
And so you also are working on some studies that pair people in prison or people who are out on parole?
Prison offenders
mm-hmm. with shelter animals. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've seen a TV show about something similar to this, but how does that program work and how did you start it and what results are you seeing?
That's a study that we have conducted that has some pretty wonderful results mm-hmm. looking at the offenders and also the prison staff. So we were fortunate to be able to have four prisons into which the animal program was about to start. So we could measure things before anything happened and mm-hmm. then after the animals came in. And what's very interesting is that we have better job satisfaction among the staff in the animal situation. And we have better self-esteem and locus of control in the offenders. Now, that's important to us because most offenders will be released, and we want them to enter into the community again with the sense that they have some ability to make change in their life that will help them succeed. That's locus of control and also self-esteem, that they do have something to offer. And what these offenders tell us is that taking care of the animal may sometimes be the first time ever that they've experienced love, either giving or receiving love. And they live with the animal in their close proximity, either mm-hmm. in their cell with a cellmate or close to their cell if or their bunk mm-hmm. if they're in a dormitory-style facility. So animals have a way of breaking things down. What we also see in that program is very interesting is that the offenders start working together outside of the training classes that are provided because they're motivated. And they want to see their animals succeed. And they feel really great when they pass the American Kennel Club canine good citizenship level when the dog passes the test because they have accomplished something.
And do you also have a program where you work with soldiers with PTSD and with horses?
We have.
And how is that program going?
We had a wonderful study. We've completed the study. The paper is in the final stages of revision. And what we found was that we could significantly decrease the post-traumatic stress levels of Vietnam veterans who engaged in our systematic riding curriculum in 3 weeks. Mm. 3 hours, 1 hour a week, 3 weeks, and we had significant decreases in post-traumatic stress. You know, post-traumatic stress is an anxiety disorder, and it's characterized by quite a few symptoms that most people would recognize, flashbacks, those kinds of things, but also somewhat extreme reactions to situations, things, even objects in this world of IED, you know, improvised explosive device wars, that people wouldn't even think would invoke or evoke an anxiety response. So what happened with the horses is the veterans are, again, seeing, hearing, touching, and smelling the horse and riding and learning to ride. So they're having a sense of accomplishment. And we have a significant decrease in the PTSD at only 3 weeks, and then it's cumulative at 6 weeks in our sample. So we had some idea around dosage. We know that we could have some benefits at 3 weeks. What needs to be looked at is how do those benefits that we've accomplished at 3 weeks play out in day-to-day life? Mm-hmm. Do they really need 6 weeks or not? Or, you know, how could we change the intervention?
Or do you need to do it every week to maintain it?
Exactly. What's the long-term need to sustain the effects?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What sort of feelings did the veterans report after spending that time with the horses?
Relaxation was the most common. They also report that they have muscles they didn't know they had because, you know, horse, you're not just lying around on a horse. It's physical activity. So it was physically beneficial for them. But mostly just that feeling of being a part of the animal's spirit, that he or she, the horse, has a spirit, and that the veteran can re-experience their own sense of spirit and connectedness to another living being. sometimes veterans are, you know, living holed up in their apartments with post-traumatic stress because they can't leave because mm-hmm. of this anxiety. Sometimes they're living out in the country in a mobile home with a lot of guns and a lot of dogs because of this. This is a serious problem that we have. When you look at the suicide rate among our military veterans, it's completely unacceptable. So we have to have a combined approach of interventions that can minimize the trauma that these individuals are experiencing.
Yeah, and a horse is a very consuming animal. I mean, it's
1,200-pound
huge.
Animal.
It requires all – like, you can barely think about anything else when you're in its presence, right? It just requires everything, which in some ways I imagine is refreshing, right, to really have to focus in that way.
Exactly. It's a break from what they were thinking about beforehand. It also gives them focus, gives them the physical exercise activity, the relaxation response. And, you know, it's really a win-win situation, I think, for veterans.
And I think I read a story paper recently that studied the horses and said that the horses were not, in fact, stressed out by the situation.
Yes, that's our paper. We often try to study the animal side as well as the human side. In this case, we looked at the cortisol levels, stress hormone levels of the horses mm-hmm. being ridden. And we needed to have a comparison group of riders. So we used a group of experienced riders, the veterans were not, and compared the horses' stress levels when they were being ridden by the veterans with those levels when they were being ridden by experienced riders. We also looked at behaviors of stress in the animals by doing videotaping and a lot of analysis of those videotapes, and found that the horses did not experience undue stress. None of the cortisol levels were such that any practitioner or veterinarian would say those animals are stressed and they shouldn't be doing this work. That was not the case at all. They did have some increase in cortisol, which means that they were working.
Mm-hmm.
And more so with the experienced riders than with the veterans.
This is Intersection on KBIA. I'm Sarah Shariari. Today, we're all about animals. Right now, you're hearing from Mizzou Professor Rebecca Johnson, who is director of the Research Center for Human-Animal Interaction.
I notice when I go around on my websites and do my daily news reading in the morning that the highest read stories are always things like, is your dog trying to emotionally manipulate you? Does your dog really love you? Is there a way that we can tell these things about animals? I mean, it sounds like from looking at their hormones that we can tell some things about their emotional lives.
We can tell many things. You know, there's some very good work going on at Duke right now regarding using functional MRIs in dogs to show that the same areas of their brain light up as with us under particular conditions, namely love. But John Bradshaw did some really wonderful work at Cambridge in indicating that dogs actually experience guilt.
I knew it. I knew they did because mine went through my trash can yesterday.
And what was the response?
It was like, you know the cat in Shrek when he makes that little guilty face? Like uh-huh. big eyes, ears pressed down, uh-huh. end of the tail wagging. I just know when they've done something even before I see what it is that they've done.
Okay. So very good. Yes. Well, what Bradshaw did was to have very well-trained therapy dogs put in the laboratory with their human mm-hmm. and a treat put on the table near the dog. The dog's put in a sit, and the human says, leave it, and puts the dog in a sit and leaves the room. Videotape is rolling. Camera's rolling. When the owner comes back in, if the dog did sin, the response was the dog would not make any eye contact with the owner.
Oh.
Would not. Avoided eye contact at all costs. If the dog was good and left the treat, the dog is looking immediately at the owner for affirmation and looking at the treat and looking at the owner and looking at the treat. It's very clear what was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
We can study these things without looking at neurochemicals. We can see in the behavior, and you can read the faces, essentially the expressions and the movements of the animal.
That's funny. I watched something, this was probably on Animal Planet, I can't remember, where they had something similar, a therapy dog, and there would be a treat, and then the trainer would close their eyes to see if the dog would eat it or not. And the dogs knew when the eyes were closed that the person couldn't see, and they would go and eat when they couldn't be seen. And I was like, I mean, they're thinking ahead. They have their little plans.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing what you can condition an animal to do also, which is why they're so beneficial in helping people as service dogs, for example. We have trained some service dogs in our work, too, with veterans and had very good success with that. And, you know, it's clear that when you have veterans who have PTSD, if they can have a service dog working with them, doing particular skills for them, picking things up or creating personal space for them in front or behind, watching when someone's coming up from behind and alerting, that you can have beneficial outcomes for the person. So, you know, this is where we can have the dog's intuitive ability to read their person and see what they need to do and make some judgments, because the person isn't saying, get in front of me and make personal space. The dog is reading the situation and getting there when they come up to a line and a checkout, for example, and getting there in that space. Or just watching when they're walking, paying attention, and sees someone coming up and knows he should alert and does so.
Are there any other skills? So it sounds like service dogs for veterans with PTSD are helping sort of control the environment in a way that's beneficial to that person. Are there any other skills that is useful in a PTSD service dog?
Sure. Well, they also are alerting the person to the situation in the environment. If it's if there's something that is of concern to them, they'll alert to their person. But what often happens too is that they awaken their person when the veteran is having a nightmare. Now, we tried to teach this, and we just couldn't simulate a nightmare and get it to work. But what we found in the service dogs that we placed is that they became so in tune to their person, to their veteran, that they started doing this anyway. Because they would recognize that something was wrong with their person and it didn't seem right to them, and they would nudge them and wake them up, or, you know, just get on their chest. In one case, the dog gets on the chest of the veteran. That wakes him up.
I bet.
And the nightmare stops.
That's really interesting. Is there anything else we should know about your work now, or possibly if somebody thinks this sounds like the best job ever, which it does, sort of how they would pursue a path towards this career? I know that you have 4 or 5 different degrees, so it's obviously not a short path.
You know, we have a wonderful new study that we haven't discussed, and everyone says, you always study dogs and you studied horses. Why don't you study cats?
Oh, the cats.
I really want to emphasize that it is very hard to study cats, because if you need to bring them into the laboratory, they'll be so stressed out that their hair will fall out, and they may not be reliable to do what you need them to do in the laboratory. However, we have a wonderful new study funded by the Human-Animal Bond Research Institute Foundation and the WIN Feline Foundation. And in that study, it's a randomized controlled trial, very swanky, you know, a scientist swanky name. What we're doing is working with families of kids who have autism. And half of them will be adopting, if they agree to, adopt pre-screened cats from the CMHS, Central Missouri Humane Society.
Yes.
And we're going to be monitoring for the social skills of the children. The theory behind the project results from some other research that indicated that perhaps children in the presence of a companion animal improve their social skills. And so one study that was done by my colleague, Dr. Gretchen Carlisle, was showing us that they don't always children don't always benefit from having a dog in their face, but they might benefit from a quieter animal that isn't quite so demanding of them, that is more independent. So the idea here is that, can we insert this animal into the family and produce a buddy feline friend, is the name of the study, for the child, and increase their social skills. But then we also want to look at what's the stress level in the cats. So we're monitoring the cortisol in the cats.
And will you ever be able to tell if cats feel love or if they're just waiting to eat us when we fall asleep?
Well, we know that cats feel love. Yeah. You can measure oxytocin in cats as well.
Really?
Sure.
That's amazing.
Mammals. You know, oxytocin is a hormone that occurs in all mammals.
All of us.
Yeah, and cortisol. So you can measure those things in them. But what it's harder to do is to draw the sample in a cat because you're going to stress them out by approaching them with a needle or sticking something in their mouth to measure their saliva. Mm. So we are using the cortisol in their feces, their droppings.
Yes.
And it's a little further downstream, pun intended, but but it's reliable.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. This is fascinating and amazing work.
Thank you, Sarah. You know, everybody likes their work. I think of my work as a mission, not work. And I think that's really important for anybody. And that's what I would say to any young person listening, that you really need to find something about which you're passionate because you work a long time. So you want to be able to sustain your passion and feel the benefits, the good feelings that come from working on something that you're passionate about.
Thank you for joining us here on Intersection. Conversations in our community. And of course, thank you to our guest, Dr. Rebecca Johnson. She is a professor at MU's Sinclair School of Nursing, a professor at the College of Veterinary Medicine, and director of the Research Center for Human-Animal Interaction. If you'd like to listen to this show again, visit us online at kbia.org. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our producers are Abby Ivory Gagna, Beatrice Costa-Lima, and Drew Matthew. Our music is Montana Skies. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM. I'm Sarah Shariari, and I host Intersection on KBIA. It's KBIA's weekly public affairs program. You may not know that the entire Intersection production staff is made up of students from the Missouri School of Journalism, and that in 2015 and 2016, Intersection was named Best Public Affairs Show in a competition with similar shows nationwide. That makes us proud. And you make it possible. Our students go on to become producers and reporters at other NPR member stations across the country. So thank you for supporting KBIA. And tune in to Intersection to hear our award-winning programming on Monday evenings at 6:30 and Wednesday mornings at 11:00.